In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
As with so many other things in life, when something makes no sense whatsoever, the government probably supports it. And if it really makes no sense, just mind-bogglingly stupid, you can bet an environmentalist somewhere is all for it. Let's stop logging to protect the spotted owl, which isn't even a native species to Oregon. All those dams and reservoirs California built back in the 1950s and 60s with more than enough water to head off 5 years of severe drought? Let's flush all that water down the streams to keep a few dozen, yes, a few dozen, fish alive. You know, when you really think about it, not only do the vast majority of environmental policies not work, but at their heart, environmental policies mean people aren't working. Keep your hands off the forests. No timber harvests. No mining. The sounds of labor and industry, of people earning their living, must be like fingernails on chalkboard to environmentalists. No saws in the forest, no machines humming in a sawmill or factory, no refineries for metals. Which might explain why we continue to have record-breaking numbers of people not working. If you're new to iSpy Radio, or just as a reminder, in the 12 states west of the Rockies, the federal government holds an average of more than 50% of the land within each state's borders. Compare that to the states east of the Rockies, where the government controls, on average, only 4% of the land. On today's show, we're going to talk about the environmentalist movement's worst nightmares, combining two things they fear most, jobs and the transfer of public lands. We'll start with Jonathan Williams to talk about jobs and the state policies that work to put people to work and how red states are attracting people to move there. And then we'll talk with Carla Jones, also of ALEC, who has evidence that the transfer of public lands really doesn't destroy the environment and does create jobs. Direct evidence of exactly what we've talked about in the past with Ken Ivory. Definitely stay tuned for that. Joining us now, though, is Jonathan Williams, who is with the American Legislative Exchange Council. Jonathan is the Vice President of the Center for State Fiscal Reform, as well as the Director of the Task Force on Tax and Fiscal Policy for ALEC. Jonathan, always a pleasure to have you.
Hey, thanks for having me back. It's great to be with you again.
Yeah, great to have you. And, you know, today's show is really a follow-up on a previous show, actually multiple previous shows that we've had regarding state lands taking control of the federal lands within their borders. But we want to talk with you about focusing really on the policies that make states successful, since this really is a major focus of ALEC. Before we get into those policies that work, though, there seems to be some depressing jobs news lately, especially for the month of August. They only had 173,000 new jobs created. That was about 50,000 fewer than expected. And then on top of that, we continue to have record number of people not working at all in terms of both numbers of people and records of percentage of the population, some 94 million people not in the labor force. Strangely, this doesn't seem to bother most economists. Can you explain why that is? Why that doesn't seem to bother them?
Well, no, I really can't. I mean, it should bother them. And, you know, if you remember from a lot of the studies done post this the Great Recession of 2008, this was the weakest economic recovery from a recession that our nation has ever seen in our history. And so this continued underperformance, the weakness in the markets, I think it has some pretty bad things to say about the general level of U.S. Market competitiveness versus other countries around the world.
You know, I guess maybe the takeaway there is economists, you can't always figure them out for one reason or another. I think I had a teacher once say that there's just no counting for economists. But anyway, we really do want to talk to you about the policies, though, that a lot of these states put in place in order to drive their own economy. And there's an article on the Heritage Foundation website by Stephen Moore and Arthur Laffer and also Joel Griffith, and it's titled "A Thousand People a Day: Why Red States Are Getting Richer and Blue States Are Getting Poor." Very similar to your own report, "Rich States, Poor States," and in this they say that two policies they find matter most: right to work and low or no income taxes. So, is there a particular reason why those two policies seem to have the strongest influence on a state's economic performance?
Well, you know, certainly I would agree, and my co-authors, Art and Steve, you know, on our Rich States, Poor States publication annually, we find that trend to be true. We're going into the 8th edition of this publication, where we rank the 50 states and analyze which kind of policies actually matter for economic growth. And, you know, you look at things like no-income tax states. We have 9 states now, including your neighbors in Washington, being states without personal income taxes. Also, Wyoming in the region, South Dakota, a little bit further to the east. These 9 states are continually outperforming the high-tax states, and this is true not only this year, not only the last 10 years, but basically since we've had reliable financial data based on the state-by-state comparisons, that relationship exists that the no-income tax states have always outperformed the states with the highest income taxes like California and New York and Maryland. And now, of course, on the right-to-work piece as well, it's becoming very apparent that the states are moving pretty quickly in the direction of becoming more right-to-work states. Now we have an equal split of the United States, mm-hmm. These laboratories of democracy, yep. As we like to say, 25 right-to-work, 25 non-right-to-work. And we may know, and we may have a 26th right-to-work state later this month if Missouri legislators decide to override the governor's veto.
Wow. Well, you know, it seems like when it comes to lower income taxes, it seems like the only people that this really seems to escape their ability to understand why this works are politicians. I mean, I always liken it to you've got two stores, one on each side of the street. One says we're raising our prices by 10% and another one that says we're cutting by 10%. Which one are people going to go to?
You know, it's as my co-author Arthur Laffer says, it's not rocket surgery. It's pretty easy. People respond to incentives, and when you lower the cost of doing something within one state and raise the cost of doing something, in this case work and savings and investment, you're going to get more people obviously going to the lower cost place to do their business and create jobs. And it's just as simple as that. And incentives matter when states are competing so directly against each other for capital, both, you know, human and investment capital. These things matter, and we find it to be very true based on the data. And the new IRS data just confirms what we found in Rich States, Poor States over the last 8 years.
Well, in the states that don't have income taxes or have very low income taxes, how do they get their funding? Is it typically through property taxes, sales taxes, corporate taxes, or maybe mineral rights?
Yeah, I mean, there's a big variety of differences across those 9 no-income tax states. Some are very heavy on natural resources, like Wyoming and Alaska, for instance. Mm-hmm. But everyone else is very diversified. You know, even a state like Texas only received something like 3% of its total budget from severance taxes from oil and gas extraction. So that really shatters the myth that you have to have, you know, huge natural resources to become a no-income tax state. I think the real key, though, Mark, is that the 9 no-income tax states spend an average of about $1,000 less per resident than the high-income tax states, and that's what allows them to go without the income tax. So taxing and spending, two sides of the same fiscal coin at the state level, since states actually have to balance their budget, apart from us in Washington, D.C., that don't even care about that.
If only Of course, that's a good thing, though. Imagine what would happen if every state had its own money printing press. Let's actually go ahead and take a break right here, because I got a kind of a full question here coming up for you on the right to work aspects of state policies. Everyone stay with us. We'll have more Jonathan Williams of ALEC. And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show. Talking today to Jonathan Williams. He's the Vice President of the Center for State Fiscal Reform for American Legislative Exchange Council. Their website is ALEC.org, if you'd like to go visit that. ALEC is a fantastic organization. They help states enact policies to make them more economically successful. In other words, they create policies that work, that put people to work, versus policies that don't and end up driving people away. And, you know, Jonathan, in that first segment there, we were talking about an article. It's on heritage.org, and we'll make sure that we link that up. But it talks about how some state policies really encourage people to move to them versus away. And the second policy, first one, of course, is income taxes, lower income taxes. People are attracted to that. But then the second policy that they really cite is the notion of being a right-to-work state. And so why don't you talk to us a little bit about that and why that tends to attract people rather than pushing them away?
You know, that's a good question. And some people try to make this into a anti-union issue, which it really isn't. It's a simple issue of employee freedom where, you know, employees ought to be not coerced to join a union if they don't want to. That ought to be part of, you know, generally American principle, right? I mean, workers ought to have that choice. And so for businesses, though, and why it matters for economic growth is it's awfully simple. When you talk to many of these businesses that are looking to invest in one state versus another, it's a yes or no decision for them. If a state's a right-to-work state, it continues along the future consideration. If it's not a right-to-work state, it goes into the no pile. And it's just a matter of fact for many businesses. They don't even want to, you know, be part of a state if it's not a right-to-work state. But secondly, you look at the results in the states that are right-to-work states, compare them to the non-right-to-work states. And as I mentioned earlier, we have about a 50-50 split exactly now, 25 states right-to-work, 25 not. You look at the economic growth in the states that are right-to-work states, and it far outpaces states that are not. So it's a question of good for employees as a freedom issue, but secondly, it's good for economic opportunity, and the states that have right-to-work are growing their economies and creating more opportunities for union workers and non-union workers alike.
Well, it certainly makes sense when you look at it from a business standpoint, when you look at all of the other hurdles that, government has a tendency to put in front of them, whether it's regulations on, insurance or regulations on worker treatment or any number of things. Now you add into that mix, you have to deal with a union. And, you know, if I'm considering one state over another, that would certainly weigh into that.
Oh, absolutely. And it goes to, you know, my parents are both teachers, former union members, and they, you know, don't believe in a lot of cases that what the union spends their dues on. And it becomes the issue of personal conscience as well. And so I think it's a two-tiered answer is, A, it matters for personal freedom that people ought to have that responsibility of their own to decide whether they want to belong. But second, it matters a whole lot for state competitiveness and future economic opportunities within the states.
Well, let's look at Wisconsin. They just recently passed some right-to-work legislation, and there's been some reports that they've got this $2 billion deficit. From the most recent articles that I've seen, that appears to be a myth. So what do you know about that, and if true, what happened to it?
Well, so, I mean, obviously, I think these are two separate issues. Is you have the budget where, you know, each year states come down to decide what they want to spend and how much they want to spend and based on the amount of tax revenue available, and then you have the right-to-work decision. Obviously, a lot of these competitiveness-enhancing measures like right-to-work are not going to take effect immediately. A lot of times we're looking at 2 to 5 years before you start to see some of the effects of, major policy changes like this, and you know, employers aren't going to pack up and leave overnight. But what it does do is it positions Wisconsin for the long term to say, yes, we're open for business. We're going to compete with my home state of Michigan, who became right to work just a couple of years ago, Indiana, which also recently became right to work. And it all of a sudden puts them in the mix for future investment. The whole budget situation is a whole other can of worms. And, you know, that's a whole long story about what decided to be spent and what decided to be taxed and a kind of a separate equation from the right to work question.
Well, in terms of transitioning to a right-to-work state, do any of these states typically experience any sort of growing pains as they make that transition? I mean, you mentioned that you don't see the effects immediately, but how long does it usually take for some of these policies to kick in where you do start seeing some of the effects of that? Is it typically that 2 to 5 years?
Well, you know, let me be clear. Sometimes, you know, people will change immediately based on that was the one thing they were holding out to say we wanted to invest in Wisconsin. All we were waiting for is right to work. So you're going to see some immediate effects. I just, you know, sometimes people will say, hey, we haven't seen a huge effect right up front. And what's wrong? But the issue is that a lot of times these investment decisions take years to happen, you know, with legal proceedings and all kinds of things that need to go on for business relocation. And so we just, you know, caution people to say, you're not going to see overnight results all the time with these competitive enhancing things like right to work. But over the course of, you know, 2 to 5 years, I think is reasonable to see some pretty significant improvements.
We did mention in the first segment there that people vote with their feet as they leave high taxes for lower ones. And there's a lot of reports that not just that Heritage one, but there's another one by Americans for Tax Reform, which I imagine is a kindred spirit there to ALEC. And it's showing this overwhelming migration, this outflow from Democrat states and inflow into Republican ones. Some of these are pretty astonishing. 3.7% increase for the zero or low income tax states versus a 2% decline
for Democrat-led states. And so you're talking basically a 6% swing there. So if the Democrat Party policies are always so great, why do taxpayers flee them if they have the means to do so?
Well, I think it gets back to your earlier example, is when you lower the price to go to one location and raise the price to go to another. Should we be surprised when more Americans are deciding to vote with their feet and go to lower tax states? I mean, it's pretty simple economics 101, and it's a little bit hard for some in the D.C. political class to understand sometimes. But when it comes to state-based policies, people are voting with their feet. You look at a place like Texas, for instance, where just in 2013, Texas gained another 152,000 Americans moving from the other 49 states on net, which they brought with them. That's the one thing you forget about sometimes. It's not just the people voting with their feet. They're taking their voting with their pocketbooks as well. And they took $6 billion in adjusted gross income from the other 49 states into the state of Texas, which, of course, enhances the revenue collection of the state of Texas going forward. Where, on the other hand, you see New York lost well over 100,000 Americans once again, and about nearly $6 billion in AGI in outflow from New York. And so this is very consistent. This is not just a one-year example. This is over the 8 years of rich states, poor states, and we've studied this. Very, very consistent to what we found.
Okay, let's go ahead and take a break right there. More on this with Jonathan Williams of Alex. Stay with us. Today we're talking with Jonathan Williams. He's the Vice President of the Center for State Fiscal Reform for American Legislative Exchange Council. Their website is alec.org if you'd like to go visit them. Great site for information and lots of insights as far as state policies. And so, Jonathan, going into the break there, we're talking about why is it that if Democrat policies are so great, why do taxpayers flee them? And I think we pretty much covered that. But the other side of that is, though, is that those are the people that can afford to flee. And you guys have been following this for about a decade or more. Do you find that this ends up having kind of an exponential effect on the states where these people are fleeing? In other words, the people that can't afford to leave, they're going to need more state help and so on. Is that what you guys typically find?
Well, I mean, there's certainly some truth to that. And when you look at those that are looking to go, they're going for economic opportunity. That's usually the number one reason that you'll see why people will flee a state. You do see some that are left behind that either A, you know, want to stay for family reasons, or B, you know, maybe like the deal that they've got currently with, you know, government benefits in some cases. Mm. So many of the high tax states are also states that offer, you know, extremely high government benefits for folks that are out of work, for instance. And so you do see some of that where you entrepreneurial folks want to leave and go to other states, and some folks are not going to leave based on current, you know, incentive structures that they have in the high benefit states.
Well, the one exception to this seems to be Oregon. Oregon, despite being a high tax state and being dominated by Democrats, according to that Heritage article, it showed a 4.3% increase in population and 6.4% increase in non-farm payrolls, which is not as good as the low state taxes, but not shabby either. Why do you suspect that Oregon is the exception to that rule?
Well, you know, I've talked to Randy Posdina, our mutual friend, who's obviously a very talented economist based out of Oregon and former vice president of research at the San Francisco Fed. And what he told me was Oregon had such a bad recovery from the recessions of the past that it's still basically underemployment is a huge issue for the state. And so while we've seen some improvement, Oregon is still kind of recovering from some of the past downturns that it never really fully recovered for in the first place. Mm. That's one good explanation, I think, and I certainly believe that. Secondly, though, I think the best economic stimulus program for Oregon is that you're the northern border of California. And so all of these Californians that have it even worse than you do in Oregon have been fleeing the state. And you look at the inbound migration, for instance, of wealth going into Oregon, and the vast majority of it is coming from one state, and that is the Golden State of California, or I should say formerly Golden State of California. And that's really the story of why Oregon's in the positive.
Yeah, that article mentioned that I think it was 1.3, 1.4 million Californians have left since 2003, and I guess that's one way to deal with their water shortage, chase people out of the state. So Oregon had a very interesting legislative session where Republican legislators claimed that it was probably the most anti-business session they had ever seen. Some of the policies that passed this session required paid sick leave, policy to force private businesses into a new state retirement plan, which in my opinion is a bailout of PERS and the unions, and then also new taxes and standards on fuels. So in terms of some of the nonsense that has come out of Oregon, what's been the outcome for other states that have passed similar legislation? I mean, in other words, what can we expect?
Well, I don't have a lot of good news there, unfortunately, Mark. The path that Oregon took this last legislative session, it had to be one of the most anti-business paths of any state in this last year. I mean, think about it in a broad spectrum. We saw more than 20 governors call for significant tax relief this year. So while the rest of the country is moving towards a very pro-growth agenda in a general way, Oregon is maybe one of the only anomalies moving pretty dead set in the other direction of higher taxes and higher labor costs. And I will say, a special mention to that Oregon public provided retirement accounts for private sector workers. That is one of the first in the nation, and I think it's really something to be concerned about for taxpayers, that as taxpayers are going to be on the hook for private sector retirements, which is, if you like what government's done with public sector pensions, which are completely in the red, this is even more, I think, scary going forward.
Yeah, it is scary, and that actually is a nice lead into my next question here, because, outside of the Portland metro area, and that seems to be the one center that does seem to still be growing in terms of job growth and whatnot, out in the rural areas, we've had a devastating wildfire season this year. Millions of acres of timber have been destroyed. I mean, this is timber that could have been harvested. These are jobs that could have been had, but unfortunately, we've just let it all burn. So when you look at these other states in terms of Illinois, or Michigan or some of these other states, and certainly some of the ones that have turned red, what was the tipping point for these states to start turning away from those punishing laws and start voting Republican?
Well, I'll say, for instance, my home state of Michigan, we went through what we call at the time the single state recession from about 2001 with that economic downturn. When the rest of the country recovered, we didn't recover. We were still double-digit unemployment. This was during the dark ages of Jennifer Granholm as governor, a horrible liberal governor. And really what it took was, Jennifer Granholm and her problems of, raising taxes drove so many people out of Michigan. People said, this is a critical moment for the state of Michigan, and we may not survive as a state the way we've known for the last 100 years. And this was a big issue. It was a turning point in 2010. The state of Michigan decided to take a completely different trajectory, embrace Governor Rick Snyder and a much more conservative legislative makeup to say, let's cut taxes, let's make Michigan a right-to-work state, and they changed the future of Michigan overnight. And it's a state now that's growing instead of being the punchline for all economic jokes out there across the country. And if it can be done in Michigan, here's the positive news, Mark, for a place like Oregon. If it can be done in Michigan, it can be done anywhere across the United States.
That is very hopeful. And it's sad, though, that tragedy is sometimes the only thing that can move people. And yet we have seen that over and over for sure. Jonathan Williams, I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Hey, always good to be with you, my friend. Keep up the good work.
All right. Thank you. And coming up next, we'll be talking with Carla Jones, also of ALEC, about the real evidence that the transfer of public lands to states actually works. And welcome back. On today's iSpy Radio Show, we're talking about policies that put people to work. We just wrapped up with Jonathan Williams of ALEC talking about state policies that can attract new people or repel them, as well as the impact of those policies on a state's bottom line. We're going to continue to analyze policies, but on a federal level and on an issue that is near and dear to us, the transfer of public lands. Except it'll be a little different because we won't just be talking about theory. We actually now have some evidence of how that process might look should the federal government take that step. To do that, I'd like to welcome Carla Jones. She is also with ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, where she is the director of the Task Force on International Relations and Federalism. Carla, it's great to talk to you.
Thank you very much, Mark. It's great to be on the program, and thank you for your interest in this issue.
Yeah, well, it's a little bit of a change for us because, when we think of ALEC, we think of state policies, and here you're the director of international relations and federalism, so that's kind of a new step for us. Is that a new task force there for ALEC?
Actually, no, it's the merging of two fairly old working groups.
I see.
And a lot of, ironically, a lot of the legislators who were interested in international issues are also interested in federalism. So we decided to merge the two. And the only thing I can think of is that you're dealing with state legislators that are thinking way beyond the boundaries of their states in both international relations and with respect to federalism.
Well, you know, states have a lot of international trade going on now, and certainly we see that here in Oregon, where our hazelnut industry exports, I should say, a lot of hazelnuts to China, and that's probably one of our main markets right now. But anyway, we want to talk to you about state lands, and you guys have a great report out there that we'll make sure that we link up on iSpyRadio.com. That you were the author of, it's called Federally Managed Lands in the West, the Environmental and Economic Implications for the States. And, you know, we have done a lot of shows on the value of transferring federally managed lands to state controls. But it's always interesting when you hear the opposition to it, because they have really two key issues that they always point to. First, they claim that it's not constitutional. And then secondly, that lands will not remain protected or open to the public if they're transferred to the states. In other words, I guess the states are going to just start raping and pillaging their own lands. So in your findings, you point to some very specific examples that pretty much takes the wind out of those sails. Why don't you tell our audience your responses to those arguments?
Well, first of all, with respect to constitutionality, transferring federal lands to state control was typically what was done until the very end of the 19th century. For example, Illinois, Missouri had more than 90% federal land ownership, and they petitioned the federal government, and the federal government did return the federal lands to state control. So this isn't something we haven't done in the past. And the only legislation that I can think of that might be problematic is the Federal Land and Policy Management Act in 1976.
Yeah.
And that says that if land is in federal control, it should only be transferred if it's in the national interest. Well, I would argue that transferring the current federal lands to state control is definitely in the national economic and environmental interest.
Yeah. Let's actually talk a little bit about that 1976 law. And in your report, you mentioned that public lands in the West were transferred from federal control via homestead initiatives. However, those slowed considerably as the 20th century approached, when the focus reversed from disposal of the public lands to preservation. That was really all part of the whole conservation movement, really inspired, I think, by Teddy Roosevelt. Anyway, codification of this shift occurred in 1976 with the enactment of the Federal Land Policy and Management Act by Congress, which affirmed that the remaining public domain lands would stay in federal ownership. And that's, I think, a really interesting point. So if those that claim that the federal government keeping land is constitutional, then it would not have required a separate act by Congress. And then secondly, if the transfer of public lands was done by an act of Congress, then it can also be undone by an act of Congress. So what are your thoughts?
My thoughts are you're absolutely right on that. And also from a federalism perspective, Supreme Court decisions have talked about how the states are equal in power, dignity, and authority. And I can't imagine anything that erodes a state's power, dignity, and authority more than not having control of its states. I mean, of the land within its state boundaries.
Well, in terms of that 1976 Act, does that act, in fact, stop any new transfers at all? Or, in other words, is that the main hurdle that has to be overcome at this point?
That is one of the main hurdles, yes. That and public opposition to it.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's another key issue for sure. In terms of overcoming that 1976 Act, and in February of 2015, earlier this year, both the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate introduced the Federal Lands Freedom Act, which would give states the authority to administer leasing, permitting, and regulatory programs for development of energy sources on federal land. So it doesn't quite transfer the ownership, but at least they are able to start developing some energy and I think mineral resources as well. So what's the fate of that bill so far?
So far, it's still in committee, unfortunately. But there have been other pieces of legislation that have been introduced in Congress. One that's kind of interesting is Congressman Amedee of Nevada has introduced legislation to transfer select lands in Nevada from federal to state control. And then there's another act that was introduced by Zinke, Congressman Zinke of Montana, and I believe it's co-sponsored by Bruce Westerman in Arkansas, and it's called the Resilient Forests Act. And basically, that's a bill that's aiming to reduce the incentive for environmentalists to sue the Forest Service, not to develop land, not to basically reduce fuel loads by cutting down timber. And they use preserving habitat for various species as the reason. However, as you've seen with the wildfires in the West, with those excessive fuel loads, you have fires, which I would argue again hurts the animals they're trying to protect far more than cutting a few trees.
Yeah, absolutely. Burning their homeland isn't exactly providing any habitat for them. Okay, let's go ahead and take a break right there. Lots more on this coming up with Carla Jones of Alex. Stay with us. And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show. Talking today about the transfer of state lands. This is a certainly an issue that is near and dear to us. We are talking with Carla Jones of ALEC, where she serves as the director of the Task Force on International Relations and Federalism. And coming up in the next segment, we're going to be talking about what this process could actually look like, because now we have some evidence of how that would all unfold. So, Carla, we were talking about in the earlier segment there on some of the hurdles that need to be overcome. And I think there's kind of another one here. This is in that report that you guys have up there. You mentioned that some of these federal lands are leased and royalties from them are split three ways. Talking about the federal lands currently that are being held in the federal trust rather than the states. And out of that royalty system, 49% goes to the state in which those lands are. 11% goes to the U.S. Treasury, and then 40%. Goes to the Federal Reclamation Fund. And that fund itself, this is a fund that Congress uses to appropriate money from to basically fund the Bureau of Reclamation Projects, which develops water projects, among others. So that in itself seems like it's going to be another hurdle to overcome in the sense that that's an uphill battle for states to kind of get past that mindset, because you're essentially asking a federal agency to give up its own funding source. Is that just one more immovable object for states to overcome?
Definitely, yes. That is going to be a hurdle. Federal agencies are in the business of perpetuating themselves.
Yes, they sure are.
So that will definitely be a hurdle.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, in terms of overcoming hurdles, because you know we talked earlier about the hurdle of overcoming public opinion. Seems to me one way to do that is to talk about the real benefits of transferring lands from the federal government to states. And you guys really raise a very key point in your study there. And you say that a study by the Property Environmental Research Center compared public lands in Arizona, Idaho, Montana, and New Mexico under federal and state control and found that for every dollar spent, the federal government only earned 73 cents per dollar spent. In other words, they're operating at a loss there.
Yeah.
During the same time period, state land trusts actually earned $14.51. So that's a huge swing.
Yes, that was one of the statistics that absolutely stunned me. And that's because of several different things. I mean, first of all, the state land trusts have a mandate to be profitable. They've got to earn more revenues than they spend. And so they have a vested interest in making sure that they lease the lands at market rates. The federal government, because of its bureaucracy, doesn't have the flexibility to adjust lease rates with market forces.
Yeah.
So part of it is the federal government is leasing land at bargain basement prices, and the state land trusts are adjusting their leases with the market. So that's part of it. The other part is that with a redundant, huge bureaucracy, you have more costs. And so the bureaucracy costs a lot more than the state land trust. And ironically, there's more oversight with the state land trust.
Yeah, isn't that interesting when you think about that? There's more oversight on the state lands versus the federal government, and yet that oversight, that actually increases the revenue that states actually take in. And, but, you know, right. when I look at the state land trust, you know, that $14, really, that's pretty low when you compare that to, like, what you might be getting for farmland or from, you know, any other kind of economically developed land. $14, that seems kind of low. And in fact, we had a previous show with Ken Ivory when he was talking about some of these state lands. Oregon is actually only a kind of a break even. Really, in terms of the amount of money that they're spending per acre versus the amount of money that they're taking in. So it seems like there's a huge upside if we actually started turning some of these state lands into revenue generators.
Yes, there would be.
Yeah.
And your schools would benefit and your roads would benefit and all of your social services would benefit from that extra revenue.
Well, the other thing that's really interesting, too, is also in your report, you mentioned that the U.S. government regulatory redundancy creates inefficiencies without conferring any readily identifiable benefits. And just to put that in perspective, you say that in Oklahoma, it takes 700 times longer
right.
to get a drilling permit on federal lands than it does on private lands. That is astounding.
Right, right. And that's the exact same thing that Canada was facing in the territories. That was one of the things that pushed them to petition for transfer of the national lands within the territorial borders to territorial control.
Mm.
And in terms of feasibility studies that the states have conducted on whether or not they are ready or want to receive possession of the federal lands within their borders, in the Montana feasibility study, they polled all of the county executives and ask them, if you're allowed to develop the federal lands within your county boundaries, do you think you could make more money from those lands than the current PILT payments in lieu of taxes and SRS subsidies that they're receiving? And they determined that, yes, they could be more profitable and better economic stewards of the federal lands within their county borders.
You know, it's kind of interesting when you're saying that. I'm thinking what's going through their heads. Well, okay, when you compare that to the federal government, they're losing money on it. So if nothing else, we can lose less money and do it slower. So, all right.
And I would argue you'd probably make money on it.
Exactly right. All right. So coming up in the next segment, we're going to be shifting gears, talking about Canada. They are actually already doing this, and we're going to be talking about some of the effects that they're already seeing. And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show. We're in our final segment now, and we are talking with Carla Jones. She is with ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, where she is the director of the Task Force on International Relations and Federalism. We've been talking about the transfer of federal lands to the states. And, you know, this is something that has been ongoing here in the United States for a number of years. In 2015, there were more than 50 transfer of public lands bills all across the United States that were either pending or adopted in different state legislatures. So this is an ongoing issue that states are recognizing that they need to take control of these state lands because they will do a better job of it. And there is an exciting example of this actually going on in Canada right now, where they have actually already started this kind of transfer. And Carla, why don't you talk to us a little bit about this? It started about back in 2003, I believe, with Yukon, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. Actually, Canada is an interesting glimpse into America's past and future, because
yes.
What they are doing now with the territories is exactly what we did with our then Western states. And also, Canada was a lot better at releasing the federal lands in the provinces to provincial control than we have been with the states. Alberta, for example, got control of all of its federal lands within the first 25 years after becoming a province. But the territories have started coming on the scene demanding more control of the federal lands within their territories. It began in the 1970s when they started complaining about the fact that the federal government in Ottawa was inefficient and unresponsive to their needs, and they wanted local control because they felt that they'd have greater accountability.
Mm.
So with UConn, what they did was they gradually started giving UConn control of little segments, like mineral development here, energy development there. And then they realized that because it's all a comprehensive whole, it would make a lot more sense to just cede control of all of the federal lands within the Yukon territory to Yukon control at once so that they could develop a more comprehensive policy. And so that happened back in 2003, and by all accounts, it's been a resounding success. And
yeah,
it has improved. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, in your report there, you say that scholars, this is, I think, in 2013, so they've had 10 years to examine this. They said that
Right. The
devolution process has had generally a positive effect on the territory, and in particular led to more efficient and responsive land use and mining permit processes. From 2003 to 2008, Yukon's mining industry expanded at an average annual rate of 10.5%, exceeding the 3.1% figure in other industries, and so huge growth there. But then also, it goes on to say that Yukon's real GDP growth exceeded the national rate, and Yukon's unemployment rate also continued to be below the national average. So it's interesting, though, that what you say is they took those first few steps, and we are kind of seeing that here in the United States, if that bill can go through that was just introduced earlier this year.
You mean the Federal Land Freedom Act?
Yes.
In terms of energy development,
yes. Yeah.
But what I would like to see is the bills that have gone through some of the Western states that are petitioning for control, I would like to see them go through, because I'd like to add grazing and timber to that, not just energy.
Yeah. Well, you know, sometimes this is a huge change, and change has to take little small steps in order to finally get to where it needs to be. What's interesting, though, is that emboldened by UConn's experience, the Northwest Territories then got their land ceded to them on April 1st, 2014. How has that gone? That's only about a year or so.
According to the premier, it's going extremely well. They don't have a whole lot of economic figures out yet.
Sure.
But all of the public faces that have talked about it have also described it as a success. And I think to underscore that, Nunavut, which is the last of the territories that needs to petition, is expected to petition by the end of the year.
Hmm.
So if it weren't working in Yukon, if it weren't working in the Northwest Territories, Nunavut would not be petitioning.
That's a good point. Are there any signs that the U.S. Congress is starting to take notice of the economic benefits of what Canada is doing?
Well, the fact that, I don't know if they're looking at Canada, but they are looking at the transfer of public lands.
Hmm.
At least they're paying attention to that. The only reason I say that is I had a meeting a couple of months ago with a Canadian MP, and I was asking him about devolution. And before he would even answer my question, his eyes went wide, his mouth went open, and he said, "I didn't think anyone in the Beltway had even heard of this." So I don't know if they're looking at the Canadian experience, although they should be, and the people that we talk to in Congress have obviously received this report. But they are beginning to look at this topic, which is huge.
Well, that is good, but it's also not a surprise that anyone in Washington, D.C. doesn't realize that anything actually exists outside of Washington, D.C. So, Carly, I want to thank you so much for your time today. I got to tell you, hearing about Canada's success is really encouraging.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
The transfer of public lands has been something we've been following and advocating for years, as I know you have. We've heard from many of you out there how important this is to you and how important it is to have local control, real local control. For those of you who have been fighting for this, for Oregon and other states to take control of their public lands, this should give you hope. Because nothing motivates spineless politicians like evidence of success. And who would have thought Canada would be showing us the U.S. the way. Go figure. For those of you on the fringe, I hope this will encourage you to get involved with the fight, because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.